Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 50 years ago, in her groundbreaking treatise, Silent Spring, on the dangers of the insecticide DDT, Rachel Carson said that we were faced with two roads, one a superhighway that would end in disaster, the other, the road less traveled. Since then, Carson has been widely credited with spurring the modern grassroots environmental movement. Joining us now to talk about that is Carson's biographer, historian Linda Lear, author of Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature. The biography was awarded the best book on women in science by the History of Science Society in 1998, and the book was republished in 2009. Welcome to the show, Linda Lear.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Rachel Carson didn't start caring about the environment. She didn't just start caring about it after studying it in college. She grew up just after the turn of the last century near Pittsburgh, which one author described as hell with the lid off. What did she take from that experience? What was she affected by that?
Oh, she was very much affected by it. She grew up in Springdale, Allegheny River town, just up river from Pittsburgh. When she was a young girl, her mother, who was very much influenced by the nature study movement, really introduced Carson to the natural world, and she became a birder. As a young woman, she wrote children's stories in the best children's magazines, and then she watched her little rural town, village, really, become polluted by the industrial debris that was going on downstream. And by the time she left Chatham College, just as the Depression broke out, her little town of Springdale was just a pit.
She was a very good writer. She was always already, you know, as you mentioned, writing and well-respected as that. But she turned to marine biology. What led her to that?
Well, a combination of, I think, her own reserve in questioning her ability to be a fiction writer. Hmm. She thought at first she would just be an English teacher, but she didn't think she had much imagination. That seems incredible looking at her work, but she was influenced by a professor at Chatham College who was in biology and switched her major, even though she was risked losing a scholarship and because women didn't have any jobs in science. It was a very radical thing to do. But she felt she could find more to write about by looking into her microscope than she could by her own imagination.
And she read, she won a National Book Award for The Sea Around Us. How did that book differ in tenor from Silent Spring?
Carson actually wrote three books on the sea. I call her the biographer of the sea. It's a trilogy. And The Sea Around Us was the second book and came out in 1951, won the National Book Award, won every kind of prize you can think of except the Pulitzer. It was a synthesis of everything that we had learned, especially from the Second World War and submarine warfare, a synthesis of oceanography, written specifically for the public. She told us about how islands were formed, how tides moved, how salinity affected different creatures, about the bottom of the ocean and what it was like. And she wrote it specifically for the public.
Right. It was very digestible. Ordinary people could appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And what was interesting is that was valued by, to get the National Book Award is no minor feat. It was interesting that it was valued at that time.
Valued and also valued by the scientific organization. She won the American Geographical Medal. So it wasn't just literary, and it was, I think, a book that made her the public voice of science. And this is very important for what would happen with Silent Spring. She was a internationally well-known, highly regarded, sensible author by the time that Silent Spring came out a decade later.
I've always loved the title Silent Spring, and I think
it's a good one.
It's fabulous, and it perfectly intones the point of her thesis. Where did it come from? How did she come up with that title?
Well, originally it was the title for the bird chapter, that there would be a Silent Spring. And she had started the book with a very heavy going chapter on chemistry, her editor suggested, Paul Brooks at Houghton Mifflin, suggested that the public was going to find that beginning rather difficult to wade through. And so instead, Carson wrote what is probably one of the most famous opening chapters in literature, called The Fable for Tomorrow, in which she told us about a real town. It's a composite of everything she had been, letters she had received from the public about what had happened when pesticides were misused and the bird song was silent. And because she'd switched that around, he suggested that she take the title of the bird chapter and make it the title of the book.
What attracted you to writing about Rachel Carson?
Well, initially it was because my students at the university, when I was teaching environmental history and got to the 60s, had no idea who Rachel Carson was. But then it became a rather personal crusade for me because I grew up in Pittsburgh, about three hills over from where Carson was born, and I really hadn't absorbed that at the time. And I found out that I had some very, very deep personal connections to Carson. My grandmother and her mother were in the same Presbyterian women's circle, it turned out. And then my high school biology teacher turns out to have been one of the other three science majors at Chatham, and Carson's best friend. Of course, she didn't come into the classroom and say, "Now, girls, you know, I was Rachel Carson's best friend." And then my parents had moved to a home, sort of in a second life home, out in a bog, the Cranberry Bog, where Miss Skinker, this very important science teacher, used to take Rachel and her students to look at wildflowers. So when I discovered all those connections, I sort of felt that this was a destiny thing.
It's the 50th anniversary of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. I'm talking with author and environmental historian and biographer Linda Lear, who wrote a book about Rachel Carson. If you have a question or comment for Linda, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. An article in E! Magazine notes that the strangest aspect of Silent Spring was that Carson's anger was toward the government, not the polluters themselves, much different than we see today. And I was wondering if you agreed with that and whether or not that changed the political dynamic or not.
Well, that's a very good question. I don't agree with it entirely, no, because Carson was not railing against the chemical industry per se, because the chemical industry simply did what the chemical industry does. It made the chemicals. Mm-hmm. What Carson was against was the misuse of the chemicals. And the misuse was carried on by primarily government agencies, federal and state, who were commissioned by the USDA and other agencies for either farm agricultural pest control or by state governments for mosquito and spruce budworm and so forth control. And it was the mixing of DDT and fuel oil and spraying it on gardens and pastures and farmlands that really caused the damage, the environmental damage. So her initial issue was not only with the kinds of chemicals that were being used, but with their application, their misuse.
Yeah, just this sentence, "If we observe the effects on wildlife, we should be worried about the effects on people."
Yes.
It's very simple, but wow. I mean, it's something we take for granted today.
That's right. And people, the final sentence, President Kennedy, of course, got in the act and detailed his Presidential Science Advisory Committee to study Carson's charges. That helped stir the controversy, of course. And the final sentence in that report says, this just always gives me goosebumps, says, "Until Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the American public did not understand that pesticides were toxic."
Yeah, we used to run behind the fog machine.
That's right.
On Sunday
and
nights.
Spray pesticides on our baby cribs and in our picnics and at our swimming pools, et cetera. Yes.
She kept secret her illness. She died in 1964, a month before her 57th birthday, of breast cancer, and didn't live to see the movement emerge. Why did she keep that secret? Why was it, and even during her testimony before Congress, she wore a wig. No,
right.
Nobody knew.
Right. Well, Carson was so criticized by the chemical companies and by the government agencies that saw her as a threat to American agriculture, that she was already being crucified as a quack, a scientist, a woman, a hysterical woman. The whole gender attack on her was really quite remarkable, and I've written a lot about that because I think it was very important. So that Carson really could not come out and say that she was suffering from cancer, because they would have said, oh, well, that's why you're writing about pesticides, because you think there's a connection between misuse of pesticides and chemical carcinogens and human cancers, and that's absurd, and you're just writing it out of your own pain. So she kept it very quiet. She would have been called even more of a quack. Carson was also very interested in the organic food movement, mm-hmm. Rodale movement, and she couldn't talk about that either because, again, that was a fringe idea back in the early 60s, and she would have been considered even more of a revolutionary than she was.
In some ways, it's considered a fringe idea even 10 years ago. Things have changed very, very quickly.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, there's efforts to overturn laws that were enacted after Rachel Carson's book now because of too much regulation. She didn't live to see the movement that she spurred, but you have said that she clearly was about more than pesticides, and you mentioned her work with Rodale and so forth.
Well, she didn't work with him, but she certainly supported.
Exactly, yeah.
Supported the idea that we should be careful what we're putting on our gardens and our plants and what we're eating.
In other words, she was fundamentally an ecologist, you've written.
That's right.
And responsible for changing our consciousness about the environment. Knowing about her, what you do, do you think she would recognize it for what it is?
The environment?
Yes.
The environmental, yeah. Well, one thing that I think the public needs to know is that Carson never called for a ban on DDT, ever. That was not in her list of things that she wanted to change. She wanted to change the misuse of pesticides. She never called for a ban on it. And that ban didn't happen until well after her death. I like to say Carson stirred up the environmental movement, but that she wasn't the founder of it or of the EPA or NEPA or the Clean Air Act or any of those things. But it is the case that the contemporary mythologizing of Carson has been done by mostly a group of very conservative think tanks around the country who fundamentally are against regulation. And they view Carson as the most successful proponent of regulation because of the ban of DDT. And so it's all rather historically inaccurate. And I try very hard to make it clear that Carson never called for a ban on DDT. She's not responsible for the world's efforts to ban DDT. DDT was still exported and manufactured in every country in the world, and it still is manufactured and used in China that we know. We don't know about South Korea. Then India just stopped its manufacture rather recently in 2009.
Linda Lear, thanks so much for joining us to talk about Rachel Carson.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Linda Lear is the author of Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature. The biography was awarded the Best Book on Women in Science by the History of Science Society in 1998, and it was republished in 2009. Coming up, we're going to talk about one of the regulations that might have been inspired by the movement that she triggered. The Clean Water Act. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the presidential race is neck and neck. What if the electoral vote ends in a tie? We'll go deep on what would happen next. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Rain for today, a high of 44 degrees. Rain mixing with snow tonight, a low right around 35. Some snow for Tuesday morning, turning into rain in the afternoon, and a high wind advisory also for Tuesday, a high of 42. Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio Northern University. Saturday, November 3rd is Discover ONU Day, allowing visiting students to learn about the blend of liberal arts and professional programs offered at ONU. Registration is open through October 31st, online at onu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Fifty years ago, rivers were going up in flames, fish were dying off in droves. Rachel Carson's new book, Silent Spring, was a sensation, but there was no EPA, no laws that dictated limits or other regulations on the use of pesticides and so forth. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, published 50 years ago this month, helped usher in a new era of awareness. And 10 years later, Congress passed the Clean Water Act. Joining us now to talk about what the Clean Water Act has accomplished and the issues facing water quality today is Dr. Juliette Christian-Smith. She is a senior research associate with the Pacific Institute's Water Program. She is also a recipient of the Environmental Protection Agency's Award for Outstanding Achievement and serves on the executive board of the Agricultural Water Management Council. She's also a Frontiers of Science Fellow for the National Academy of Sciences. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So October 18th was the 40th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, which regulates pollutants that are discharged into our waterways and quality standards for water. But the Federal Water Pollution Control Act had been around since 1948. What was the difference?
In the 1970s, the Federal Water Pollution Control Act was renamed the Clean Water Act and came along with a series of much stricter regulations. And the biggest one is that the nation decided that there was no right to pollute our public waterways. And this came after, as you mentioned, many rivers were catching on fire. The Cuyahoga River, mm-hmm. in fact, was considered one of the fires that sparked the interest in the Clean Water Act. All of the municipal waste, the oils, the debris, they actually, if you stuck your hand in the river, it would cake it with debris and mud and slime. So people were concerned about this, and they put in a large bipartisan majority of Congress approved, actually over the veto of President Nixon, the Clean Water Act reforms, and this included a goal to reduce and completely eliminate pollution by 1985.
Well, before we move on to that, those goals, what did President Nixon object to?
I think that the history shows that there was an interest in reduced government, and this was considered a huge change in terms of the ability for the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate the amount of pollutants that came out of pipes into waterways and actually monitor that and fine industries and point source polluters if they exceeded their pollution limits.
Because override of a veto is a big thing. So most people or most of the nation was behind it.
Right. It was a different time period. There was a lot of consensus around the problems with the development, the rapid expansion of municipal areas, and some of the downsides that we didn't know about when we started constructing dams and started putting pollutants into waterways. The idea was that the diffusion was the solution to pollution. And eventually we saw that that wasn't happening any longer and that we were actually creating what and some people called the Cuyahoga River, a giant sewer running through Ohio. So it wasn't diffusing, and we had to start dealing with the waste we were creating.
So you mentioned that the goal was to eliminate water pollution by 1985. How have we measured the success and or failure of the Clean Up Water Act based on that?
Well, we now have to get permits to discharge pollutants from pipes, and these are called NPDES, non-point discharge elimination system permits. So you have to track how much you're actually discharging, how many pollutants you're discharging per year. And in 2006, for instance, about 7,000 of the facilities with NPDES permits exceeded their permit at least once during the year. About 57% of those facilities exceeded their permit at least once during the year. So we have the permits in place, but we have not achieved that elimination of pollution that we wanted at the beginning of the act.
Is it possible to achieve that goal, given what we know now in the last, 25 or 30 years?
I think it is possible. The question is whether there's the political will to do so. In the case of exceeding your NPDES permit, you do have to pay a fine, but those fines are relatively small and in some cases are considered a cost of business. If we increase those fines, it would be more of a disincentive, and it could actually provide a funding stream. So another huge problem with the Clean Water Act is that it's enforced by the Environmental Protection Agency. And when the Environmental Protection Agency's budgets are cut, its monitoring and enforcement is not able to keep up with the new contaminants and the new permits that are being put into place.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Dr. Juliette Christian-Smith. She's an author and senior research associate for the Pacific Institute. On October 18th, it was the 40th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, and that's what we're talking about right now. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Christian-Smith, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So we're in an era again. You said at the time President Nixon, was on the side of small government, and that is what inspired him to veto the legislation 40 years ago. They overrode the veto, of course, but we're in another era of small government, preference for small government. It's a very big issue in this day and age. And the law is already said to be out of date and, as one writer put it, desperately in need of new thinking about water. How do you move forward and update a law like that without creating more regulation? Or can you not?
Well, one of the major weaknesses of the law is that it doesn't adequately monitor or regulate non-point source pollution. So that's just a way of saying pollution that doesn't come out of a pipe. That's runoff primarily from our city streets, from our farms, and as water runs through the streets, it picks up debris, oil, heavy metals, sediment, salts. As it runs through the farms, it picks up pesticides, fertilizers, nutrients, pathogens. And all of these things eventually end up in our surface and groundwater bodies. And we find them in many cases, they are polluting and leading to impairment. So in 2006, 40% of surveyed rivers and streams were considered impaired in the United States, and 60% of lakes were also impaired. And we're at a point now when we have drastically reduced the amount of point source pollution. We don't have rivers burning any longer, but we do have a huge problem with non-point source pollution, and it's now the leading polluter of our waterways. And designing systems to actually enforce reductions in non-point source pollution is the big challenge we have coming up in the 21st century.
George in Millersport, you're on the air. Welcome, George. Hello, George. Hello, George in Millersport. Okay. We are having a little technical difficulty there. We'll have our screener recheck George in Millersport to see if he's still around. In the meantime, the House passed a bill last year, and two senators recently introduced a companion measure that would, by some estimations, gut the Clean Water Act. Opponents say that regulation should be done by the state and that the EPA has overreached its mandate. What about the state, and what about leaving the regulation to the states? Could it be done better that way or not?
Well, there are some problems with leaving it to the states. I think one of the issues is funding. One thing we haven't talked about that was part of the Clean Water Act is the state revolving fund. This is actually an extremely successful financial instrument. The federal government loans money to the states at a very low interest, and they use that money to deal with Clean Water Act compliance. So they help companies and farms and install new technologies and treatment to ensure that we're reducing our water pollution. And it's been very successful. It's led to a lot of local cost share matches. And for every dollar that the federal government has put in, there's been at least $2.50 of creation of infrastructure and treatment at the local scale. So if you devolve all funding and regulation down to the states, you lose some of the benefits of bringing in the federal government, which is many times related to resources that they can provide, both financially and also scientifically. They have monitoring networks that they maintain, and that gives us the information about how well we're doing.
George in Millersport, are you there?
I am, yes.
Hi, welcome.
And please ask Ms. Christian Smith what she thinks about fracking in eastern Ohio and western Pennsylvania, and what the spinoff is in terms of the effluent going into streams, and how that could and should be controlled.
Well, that's a great question, George. We get a lot of people interested in hydraulic fracturing or fracking these days. As you might know, the Energy Policy Act of 2005 exempted hydraulic fracturing from regulation under the Clean Water Act. So we actually don't have a lot of information about the chemicals that are used, although the Environmental Protection Agency has now been investigating what goes into the wells. When a well is fractured, an oil well or gas well is high-pressure water and chemicals and sand are injected to fracture the rock and allow the well to become more productive. And this involves a massive amount of water and where some of the water comes back up, and that's called process water. And I think, George, that might be what you're discussing mostly. That process water can be put into large holding areas, or it can be discharged into rivers, or it can be taken to local sewage treatment plants. And in all of those cases, there are concerns about what's in that process water and how that might affect human health and environmental health. And that's a growing area of research. There's a lot of different situations in different states, but there's in New York State, for instance, they've decided to take the precautionary principle approach and ban hydraulic fracturing until they can figure out what it actually means for ecosystems and humans.
Thank you, George.
The fracking industry is very secretive about what is in what chemicals are used. And it creates suspect as to the fact that they're off the chart. But you've covered my question, and I thank you very much for your input.
Thanks for the call, George. Right. The demand on water is increasing as well, the demand for water. And there's a lot of pressure coming from particularly the Southwest and the West for water in the Midwest. To what extent does that play into this finely balanced equation of safe water for the country?
Well, you can't separate water quality and quantity, and you can't separate surface water and groundwater, and yet our legal framework does all of those things. So in many cases in the nation, we are having increased water demand due to new uses, population growth, and also climate changes. Outdoor water demand will increase as we have warmer days and nights, and that increases the evaporation
right.
from soils and also transpiration of plants. Plants require more water. And so you're going to see changes in outdoor water demands both in cities, which actually about half of the water used in cities is usually used outdoors, surprisingly, and also certainly in agriculture as crop water demands increase, particularly in the western United States. Preparing for climate change is something that the federal government has not taken a huge lead on, and states are, in many cases, ahead of the curve and are developing things like adaptation plans to try to understand how their water resources will change and how they are going to deal with those impacts.
And does having less water or having to spread it around more, I mean, the idea of moving water around, is that of concern to people who support the Clean Water Act and the goals that are set forth in it?
Moving water around as in interbasin transfers or?
Well, from the Midwest to the Southwest, for instance, from the Great Lakes.
Right. A lot of we wrote a book recently, a 21st century U.S. water policy,
mm-hmm.
and much of the book focuses on the past or the 20th century approach to water. The 19th and 20th century approach was really this, what we call the hard path. It was how do we make more and more water available through dams, diversions, large transfers of water, and what we've found is that in many cases those approaches have led to a lot of unintended impact from major ecosystem degradation to actually becoming reliant on sources of water that locals don't control. For instance, in California, we have a large battle going on between Southern and Northern California
mm-hmm.
over water. And so what we have suggested, and we've provided a pathway to what we call a soft path, and that is actually trying to utilize local resources better and be able to think about water in both a centralized in some cases, but also decentralized context. So thinking more about how to use local water resources more efficiently and get more out of local water resources, rainwater harvesting, recycled water, gray water reuse. A lot of the water that we see as waste today is actually very valuable water that all over the world people are realizing is new water for the future.
Well, Dr. Juliet Christian-Smith, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Juliet Christian-Smith is an author and senior research associate for the Pacific Institute. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the big storm headed our way. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In the heat of an earlier presidential campaign, a caller to this program got an email from her CEO.
That characterized anyone that opposed the war or the president as unpatriotic and un-American, and I just didn't know what to do about it.
Bosses who tell workers how to vote, arguments on Facebook, and in the break room, I'm Neil Conan, Politics at Work, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow at 10 o'clock for a look at the role of the third-party candidates in the electoral process. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow at 10. Expect rain today and a high of 44 degrees, more rain for tonight mixing with a little snow, and a low of 35. Some snow expected Tuesday morning, turning to rain in the afternoon, and also a high wind warning, and a high of 42. And a rain with a little snow Tuesday night, a low of 35. Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. Information about how Montgomery & Associates can help you achieve your financial goals can be found online at their website, themontgomerysolution.com. And support for 89.7 comes from Methodist Theological School in Ohio, a gateway to lives of lasting significance. MTSO prepares religious leaders to guide and serve their communities with intellectual integrity and a commitment to justice. More at www.mtso.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Just in time for Halloween, there's the Frankenstorm, and there is reason for millions of Americans to be spooked. Forecasters say the storm, properly known as Hurricane Sandy, has what it takes to turn into a superstorm as it collides with a very big cold front. States of emergency have already been declared in 9 states ahead of Sandy's expected landfall tonight, somewhere in central or southern New Jersey. The National Weather Service issued an intense warning last night, saying Sandy has potential to be a historic storm, and that if anyone is reluctant to evacuate, to think about their loved ones and the emergency responders who won't be able to get to them. But it's not just coastal areas that should be concerned. It could affect areas as far west as Ohio. So we called up Ben Gelber, NBC4 meteorologist Ben Gelber, to walk us through this, and he obliged us. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Good morning, Ann.
So it's a superstorm. You know, I was talking to somebody earlier today that says they remember when they were 50 years ago when they were in Atlantic City and the surge brought the water up to the second floor of the hotel they were staying in. And that was 50 years ago. And they're saying this is the storm of the century.
Yeah, it just is a very, very bad scenario for such a wide swath of the East Coast and then inland. Of course, they're referring to then Hurricane Donna that came up the East Coast. That was moving kind of south to north at a pretty good pace and had a great deal of wind and wave action in 1960 in September. This storm is moving rather remarkably from ultimately will go east or southeast to northwest. So this is a completely different and kind of unprecedented track for a storm to make a hard left turn out in the ocean as it runs into, as we showed over the weekend, what we call an Atlantic block or blocking high pressure center. In the wintertime, we call it a Greenland block. But essentially, it hit a wall, and it's going left. And it has intensified to 90 mile per hour winds now, central pressure 27.85. So this is a stunning storm in scope and intensity.
Tell me what the 27.85 means.
Well, that's just an incredibly low pressure. Now, the winds, usually with storms this deep, would be even stronger. I think it's just because it's not a compact storm, but spread over such a huge area that we're not seeing even stronger winds, but it's just going to have an immense size and impact. I mean, on satellite, you can see cloudiness from eastern Canada, the Gulf of Mexico, just about back to the Mississippi River. So it's just, you know, if there ever was a superstorm, this would be it. Actually, we're lucky it isn't more compact because then winds would probably be 150 to 180 miles per hour given the intense low pressure. I mean, we're seeing pressures that are as low as some of our Category 3, Category 4 storms. But again, peak winds now sustained are 90 miles an hour, with the storm about 200 miles southeast of Atlantic City.
My guest is NBC4 meteorologist, CMH NBC4, Ben Gelber. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about the big storm headed our way after it hits the East Coast. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. The National Weather Service, I mentioned earlier, issued the warning, that warning almost begging people to heed the evacuation orders and think about their family and first responders. It seems sort of dramatic to read that. Is it out of character for the National Weather Service to put it that way, or have they been doing that?
I think they have to do that. When you see a storm that is remarkable in so many ways, again, there's no real analog for a storm like this, where we're essentially taking a hurricane, blending it with a couple of we'll call polar systems or storms of Canadian origin. So you now have this tremendous clash of air masses. Normally, it's just a big tropical warm core type of system, but essentially you're going to have a hurricane with non-hurricane characteristics or extratropical, as we call them, embedding or rather encasing this hurricane core and eventually enveloping it. But we're not sure exactly how this is all going to play out. I mean, the closest analog is Not Good, which was the perfect storm in, around this time in 1991, but all that happened out over the North Atlantic, and it still caused $200 million damage, and that was well off the coast of Maine and New Hampshire. So this, unfortunately, is happening as the storm makes landfall this evening, probably near just south of Atlantic City.
They're saying it's like almost a week-long, five-day or six-day event. Is that moving very slowly, or is that pretty typical, or what?
Well, there's nothing typical about this one
right.
at all. I mean, there was an Agnes when I was a kid growing up in Pennsylvania that did do a short left turn from the ocean and did a circle over New York and Pennsylvania and caused, you know, catastrophic flooding in the Susquehanna River Valley with upwards of 20 inches of rain and immense damage and took 122 lives. Yeah, and that storm was not nearly as strong as this, but that also sat for about 4 or 5 days and spun around before looping back off to the northeast. This one, Sandy, will migrate probably along the Pennsylvania-Maryland border and then settle, get about as far west as the Pittsburgh area, and then sort of spin down a little bit. In other words, pressures will rise, but we're going to be dealing with several days of initially high winds and then just strong and gusty winds and persistent, kind of annoying, light wind-blown rain, but not flooding here. We're not looking for rain of that intensity. And then the storm will eventually, like Agnes, toward the end of the week, work its way off to the north and east, and hopefully we'll be done with it by Thursday and Friday. But at least the first half of the week, today actually is not the worst day by any means, even though we're having, you know, chilly rain and wind and maybe even some wet snow to factor in tonight, tomorrow morning. And I could see several inches of snow over higher terrain, especially south and west of Columbus. And we'll just have to keep an eye on temperatures. The ground may be warm enough to keep us out of trouble, at least here in the urban corridor. But it's going to be a close call. And I've already been talking to the city, and we're going to just have to take it hour by hour because it's such a unique situation. And it's only late October.
Exactly. We're talking about blizzards. Is that right? In some of the mountainous areas between here and the coast?
Yeah. I mean, and I can't imagine if we were just a little bit colder, we'd be talking a blizzard here as well. We're going to have 30 to 50 mile per hour winds this evening into the day tomorrow. And if we do turn over to snow, which is likely in most areas, at least for a portion of the night, it could resemble a blizzard, although for us, again, a lot of it would be melting on contact. And then back over to rain. But areas that are a little bit colder, and that could even be some of the elevated sections from the Bell Fountain Ridge and then across higher terrain in southern Ohio into northeast Kentucky and definitely West Virginia, where there could be inches, and in the case of West Virginia, feet of snow with 30 to 50 mile per hour winds. That will be a blizzard, again, unprecedented for October. So this is just an extraordinary situation.
We have an email from James. He writes, is the current cloudiness and rainfall part of Sandy?
I guess now we could say it is. Initially, it was part of the cold polar system migrating in what we call an upper air trough or big dip in the jet stream. And that was really yesterday's rains and today's, for that matter, not really Sandy. But you can see the moisture from the east, which would be the extreme outer bands of this storm, rain bands anyway, starting to converge with this colder system. So at this point, things are going to be enmeshed, and now we can start to say it's part of the, we're definitely into the Atlantic portion of the storm. Again, it's just becoming a merger, and we're going to have to see, you know, this will be one for the history books. We'll have historic low pressure, especially to the east of the Appalachians, some of the lowest barometric pressure readings ever recorded on the mainland, if not all-time record. I think Minnesota had set a record a couple of years ago with some surface pressures down around 28.10 to 15. So we probably will break that for the lowest continental U.S. pressure. By comparison, in 1978, we dropped to 28.47. Now, we probably won't get that low here, but again, I'm talking, you know, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, New York will set surface pressures down close to 28 inches, which is just unfathomable.
And the point is we just don't know what's going to happen because of that.
Well, yes. I mean, and I think that's part of the warnings. And while I think we know most of what's going to happen, I think we're still going to be, you know, watching and recording this storm. I mean, we know there will be areas of 6 to 12 inches of rain in the mid-Atlantic. We know there'll be 60 to 90 mile-per-hour winds and maybe a few higher gusts along the coast. We know there'll be interior winds of 40 to 80 miles per hour east of the Appalachians and 40 to 60 miles per hour west of the Appalachians. So I think that in the track, and then this band of incredibly heavy snow in West Virginia, and moderate snow possibly even in southern and west central Ohio, and for a period for us too. So I think we have all that figured out, and yet we're still going to be watching to see how this all plays out.
My guest is Ben Gelber, meteorologist at WCMH NBC4. If you have a question or comment for Ben about the big storm, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rita in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rita.
Hi, yeah, good morning. I was wondering, I thought I heard this morning that this storm now is passing over the Gulf Stream, which is like rocket fuel for these storms. And I'm wondering if this storm has the potential to be like the hurricane of 1938, which devastated the Northeast, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and that area. Could it suddenly intensify?
Well, and yes, and the hurricane of 1938 is probably the greatest East Coast disaster. Now, of course, that was following a more traditional south-to-north track, except it accelerated at speeds of 60 miles an hour. You're correct, it caught the warmer waters of the Gulf Stream, as Sandy is doing. But that storm produced winds to 186 miles an hour in eastern Massachusetts and inundated southeastern New England and Long Island. This storm is not moving anywhere near that speed, nor will it have the concentration of winds. But that storm also did catch, as Hazel did in 1954, another monumental storm caught, tapped into very strong jet stream winds. So those were south to north storms that, of course, stayed completely east of the Appalachians and devastated. In the case of the 1938 storm, New England and the far eastern portion of Long Island, 1954, that was 100 mile per hour winds getting into eastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So those are two storms that are as bad as we've seen. Again, this one, because it's moving laterally, sort of like the quarterback handing the ball off to a running back and going across the field before making a cut. This is such an unusual track. We'll have to see, you know, exactly how much of that wind is going to come down to the surface and how that's going to impact also wave heights. I mean, the other aspect of this is a possible record storm tide in New York City that could inundate lower Manhattan. Last year, Irene had a 4.5 above normal storm tide, and this one could produce 6 to 9 foot above average values, and you know that could really be catastrophic for Long Island and parts of New York as well as you know New Jersey and Delaware. So again, these are the things that and that's why the high end warnings. I mean, it's as bad as it can get.
Okay, but you don't think it's going to suddenly intensify before it makes landfall?
Well, it already did.
Okay.
I mean, it's gone from 75 to 90 miles per hour, and the pressure has dropped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's
mm-hmm.
probably exactly what is occurring. Now, what happens from here to the coast? Probably not much change.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, once storms go inland, friction begins to slow the winds, and the pressure comes up a little bit. But what Ann alluded to is where we're in a little bit of uncharted waters here is that when you absorb, you know, a polar system, that can actually sustain the stronger winds or the wind fields and maybe expand it a bit and keep pressures abnormally low, whereas other storms might have begun to break up a little bit faster. This one will be quite strong for quite some time.
Mm.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Rita.
Mm-hmm.
Take care.
Thanks, Rita.
Brian in Columbus, you're on the air with Ben Gelber. Welcome, Brian.
Hi. I'm curious as to what sort of effect this will have along the Lake Erie border, kind of up along the Cleveland-Buffalo area. part of the reason I'm curious is I actually have to drive up to Toronto on Wednesday, and it sounds like it's going to be an unpleasant day for driving.
Yeah, Wednesday, again, the storm will have weakened quite a bit, but still there'll be battering waves. I know concern for 25-foot waves on Lake Erie and even 15-foot waves perhaps on Lake Michigan. So there's going to be incredible wave action over the lakes, and that's going to pound the North Shore. You know, Cleveland and Erie and all those areas, I think, are going to be hard hit. So, I mean, this is going to be, you know, the wide-reaching ramifications unless the storm were to take some kind of unexpected jog or unexpectedly weaken. And at this point, that's, you know, looking increasingly unlikely that there will be much, if any, mitigating factors with the storm. But you're absolutely right. There'll be a whole other component to the storm, which will be Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, particularly Lake Erie and the lakeshore areas. Now, the trajectory of the winds is important, too. In this case, the winds will be coming in out of the east and southeast. That might drive the water more toward the Canadian side, but eventually some of that water is going to come back onto the Ohio side, or as we call it, the North Shore.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Oops, sorry about that. Gloria in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gloria.
Hi. I was wondering, with temperatures around 35 and with high winds, how do you think this will affect the vegetable and flower gardens, which are still thriving?
I don't think they'll be thriving much longer. The only thing is we won't have a hard freeze. In fact, we may not.
Right.
We won't freeze at all.
Right.
So I think the damage would be strictly wind and in areas, high terrain areas that do get several inches of snow that could, you know, snap some, you know, what's left of some vegetable crops and all that. Snow itself can be an insulator, too. So, again, it won't be the freezing component at all. And the wind chill it does not apply to flowers or inanimate objects either. So wind chill is just us. But, yeah, so even if we see wind chills in the teens or 20s, that's meaningless. It's the air temperature. On the other hand, areas that do accumulate snow, even though it would melt very quickly, in fact, it mostly melt by morning, but I suppose there could be some impact there, too.
Okay. Thanks, Ben.
Sure.
Thanks, Gloria. And Jonathan in Lancaster, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
I just had a quick question of, you know, a lot of airports are canceling flights, but are flights that are already, like, at 20,000 or 30,000 feet, are they affected by the storm? Take my question off there.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Jonathan. So how high up is it?
Well, I mean, we can see the reflection of the storm probably 10 to 20,000 feet. Obviously, you know, the main impacts are going to be in the lower levels, but nonetheless, with this storm merging with an upper air storm, there is a very strong jet stream, anomalously strong upper level winds as well. So in this case, this would impact, you know, flying in terms of turbulence pretty much all the way up through jet stream level or where the jets fly.
Hey, Ben, given the historical nature of this storm, do you sleep during these kind of times?
Not really. And granted, the, you know, the main impact will be, you know, well to our east, and we're just going to have a windy mess tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I usually wind up pulling some form of double duty, so
right.
Or triple duty, and the same, for example, whether it's the derecho on June 29th or the March blizzard in 2008 when we had upwards of 20 inches of snow. You know, it's not uncommon for me to work 18 straight hours sometimes, or, you know, with a short break and then back in. This one, we're just going to have to see how things go this evening.
Mm-hmm.
Off to our east. And, of course, we'll keep you posted on NBC4.
Well, Ben Gelber, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure, Ann.
It's Ben Gelber, meteorologist for NBC4. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.